interrupting the current neo-uronial, climate-challenged, behaviorally-controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 658. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind the woodshed. Don't let them do it to you. Don't go out without a fight. Maybe if you get behind the woodshed long enough, you'll learn to stay out of the harm's way because you've been doing some research and reading that black and white and understanding that the occupier treats you through that, whatever your opinion to the contrary might be. It has been coming more prevalent here over the weeks and weeks, especially under the Trump regime. We may not have a choice if we want to be a spectator when the bony finger of political corruption points at you, whether or not you are doing anything wrong. Justice Department drafting a list of domestic terrorists. The Justice Department memo calls for a cash reward system that would encourage Americans to report suspected domestic terrorist activity. Can you hear the social credit system coming right behind this? The memo says domestic terrorism could be inspired by a number of things, such as opposition to law and immigration enforcement or support for radical gender ideology. The memo focuses on what it calls Antifa-aligned extremism and omits mentions of rising domestic threats, such as violent white supremacy. And that is our note to know that there's going to be no limit in the future. Whatever the bony finger of political corruption doesn't like is going to be able to be pointed out in the future. And this is all coming through what the PAITRST Act did to us, and no one really said much of anything about it, and not focused on that weakness where we're all considered criminals to start with. The Justice Department leadership has directed the FBI to compile a list of groups or entities engaged in acts that may constitute domestic terrorism by the start of next year, and to establish a cash reward system that incentivizes individuals to report on their fellow Americans, according to a memo reviewed by the Times. Law enforcement agencies are directed in the memo dated December 4th to identify, quote, domestic terrorists who use violence or the threat of violence to advance a political or social agenda, including adherence to radical gender ideology, anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, or anti-Christianity. Can you imagine what they do with a guy behind a woodshed? Do they even understand what they're listening to? Although the memo does not mention protests against President Trump's immigration crackdown directly, it says the problematic, quote, political and social agendas could include, quote, opposition to law and immigration enforcement, extreme views in favor of mass migration and open borders. Who's making those decisions anyway? And to what extent? The memo sent by Attorney General Pam Bondi to federal prosecutors and law enforcement agencies follows on a presidential memorandum signed by Trump in the immediate aftermath of the killing of Charlie Kirk, a prominent conservative figure that gave civil rights groups pause over the potential targeting of political activists, donors, and nonprofits opposed to the president. And this just brings up the other question I mentioned. What was the real purpose behind the Kirk assassination, if you go with the narrative? The memo outlines what it says are causes of domestic terrorist activity, including hostility towards traditional views on family, religion, and morality. So I call your attention to what was supposed to be a memorial. It ends up being, to my mind, a big mental programming event where a couple hundred thousand people were listening in and getting the information they would need to be sent back out to be ticking time bombs, as I said at the time, to turn on the situation once they're told to. That sounds like one of the triggers. Federal law enforcement will prioritize this threat. Where federal crime is encountered, federal agents will act, the memo states. And I didn't hear any room made for the First Amendment, did you? The homegrown, all y'all, just like the Patriot Act, P-A-T-R-I-O-T Act, intended, now being implemented by so-called conservatives. Some national security experts said the memo represented a dramatic operational shift by directing federal prosecutors and agents to approach domestic terrorism in a way that is ideologically one-sided. At worst, critics said the memo provides legal justification for criminalizing free speech. And this is what I've been highlighting over and over with Trump. He just needs that, like Obama, there's no difference in these folks. They just get that murder memo, so to say, and they're off to the races and off to the droning competition. I think this causes a chilling impact because it definitely seems to be directing enforcement towards particular points of view, Mary McCord, the former acting assistant attorney general for national security, said in an interview. The memo, for example, primarily focuses on Antifa-aligned extremism, but omits other trends that in recent years have been identified as rising domestic threats, such as violent white supremacy. Since Trump resumed office, the FBI has cut its office designated to focus on domestic extremism, withdrawing resources from investigations into white supremacists and right-wing anti-government groups. And I'll just call your attention to anybody who was witnessing what was going on in the 80s. There was white supremacist anti-government groups that were popping up, becoming fodder for the government to continue its bludgeoning of people and what they believed, and putting down people instead of treating them fairly and correctly, educating them to show what's in the law to be done. They just created everybody to be an anti-government group, and the people really started to not like that too much over time. And I get this feeling that they're pushing on that again now that they have this thing a little more corralled and controlled. And then here we go, going into the digital gulag. They're going to be able to track all this stuff. And they already can a lot of it with your phones anyway. So this is what we saw with the J6. The memo is pushed to collect intelligence on Antifa through internal lists and public tip lines, also raised questions over the scope of the investigative mission and how wide a net investigators might cast. Whether you're going to a protest, whether you're considering a piece of legislation, whether you're considering undertaking a particular business activity, the ambiguity will affect your risk profile. Thomas Brzozowski, a former counsel for domestic terrorism at the Justice Department, said in an interview. It is the unknown that people will fear, he added. So, as I've said before, a government that rules by fear, intimidation, or dread is terrorism. You just find that in a dictionary. Not the government's terrorism. It's what is terrorism. Again, we have street language we can use in this regard. It is up to us in the final say when we stop the nonsense. As it is stated, we have the right to alter and abolish, which I keep saying is a license for these people to continue to violate you. Now, before, where it just said enforcement would be encouraged here, law enforcement agencies are directed in the memo to zealously investigate those involved in what it calls potential domestic terrorist actions, including doxing law enforcement. Authorities are also directed to map the full network of culpable actors potentially tied to crime. So this is a very interesting problem that we might be seeing, where we, the people, may want to know who these people are that are in under color of office and supposedly law enforcement. They're turning around right now to say, we don't think we're going to let you do that. Now, whether they want to call it doxing, I don't know. I don't really know the extent of all that. But this is where we're seeing, again, governments turning the guns in the gates and going after anybody who will not like what the government does, and that's going to be who it's going to be targeted. Domestic terrorism is not an official designation in U.S. law. So take note of this thing. Domestic terrorism is not an official designation in U.S. law. But the directive cites over 24 existing laws that could substantiate charges against domestic extremists and their supporters, such as conspiracy to injure an officer, seditious conspiracy of mail, and wire fraud. So I would suggest certainly go to those laws, look at them and see their elements, and make sure you don't do any of those or don't do a thing that can be considered as such, and look ahead of the problem and don't get caught up in it. Only in a footnote of the memo, does the Justice Department acknowledge that the United States government cannot investigate, collect, and maintain information on U.S. persons solely for the purpose of monitoring activities protected by the First Amendment. Quote, no investigation may be opened based solely on activities protected by the First Amendment or the lawful exercise of rights secured by the Constitution or laws of the United States, the footnote says. So there it is, a footnote. At least it's a footnote, right? Some tension could arise when citizens report what they believe to be suspected domestic terrorism to the FBI. Which is an interesting catch-22. The memo directs the FBI outline tip line to allow witnesses and citizen journalists to report videos, recordings, and photos of what they believe to be suspected acts of domestic violence and establish a cash reward system for information that leads to an arrest. Well, people will inform because they will get paid, Brzozowski says. He added that some information could end up being unreliable and likely be related to other Americans exercising their constitutional rights. Do you think being swatted here as well? Now we're going to also enhance that with Palantir's use of error-prone AI. State and local law enforcement agencies that adhere to the Justice Department's directives will be prioritized for federal grant funding. So the bribe is on, as we watch what's going on, to create a suspect from anybody. Remember, it was about your behavior. It's a few episodes back, if not last episode, and episodes before. It's about looking at your behavior. They decide what that is. The mission will cross several agencies with the FBI working alongside joint terrorism task forces nationwide. This has been going on since the Patriot Act, as well as the Counterterrorism Division and the National Threat Operations Center, among others, to provide updates to Justice Department leadership every 30 days. To do what? Is not explained. Probably to abuse us more. FDA claims COVID shots killed 10 children and vows new vaccine rules. So you're going to be a domestic terrorist for trying to counter the government's bad actions. And then 5 years later, we're going to come up with the idea, well, it was a bad action. If you can see how this starts to roll out. Here we are now. The FDA is doing an interesting thing here as they're changing up the personnel. The director of the Food and Drug Administration Vaccine Division told agency staff in a memo that an internal review found that at least 10 children died, quote, after and because of receiving the COVID vaccine. So let's understand, we hear lots of this, I've seen this number go through, everyone's saying it's 10 children. No, it's at least 10 children died, at least by this first paragraph. The memo will cite a little bit different situation, but makes it sound worse to me. The 3,000-word memo obtained by NBC News was written by Dr. Vinay Prasad, director of the FDA Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. And that word, biologics, be careful when you go to the hospital and sign any documentation. They'll have this new word, biologics. It says they have permission to give them to you. And inside the word biologics is vaccines and a whole lot of other stuff. So you don't want to agree to that if you possibly have the ability. In it, Prasad claims that agency staff determined that, quote, no fewer than 10, close quote, of 96 child deaths reported to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, between 2021 and 2024 were related to COVID vaccinations. He said the true numbers could be higher, accusing the agency of ignoring the safety concerns for years. So first of all, the VAERS is said to be an underreporting system. So he's very correct. I think it would be much higher. So it's the actual phrase he used was no fewer than 10. Not at least, but no fewer. This is a profound revelation, Prasad wrote in the memo. For the first time, the U.S. FDA will acknowledge that COVID-19 vaccines have killed American children. Prasad suggests that the child deaths were tied to myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart muscle, but doesn't include evidence to support the claim. He outlined a series of proposed changes to how the FDA evaluates vaccines. I'm going to get back to the support the claim evidence. There's just been two more studies that showed that myocarditis, the inflammation happens, and the mechanism now, I think one of the universities just found the mechanism for that it does happen. So this is on the horizon coming. I didn't have the chance to pull all this together. But also, I'm not here to report to you all the goings-on. I could never do it in a broadcast. I'm just trying to show us that we have a lot coming at us and a lot we can do about it if we just would, and how to look at the world, how it's running, and reevaluate for ourselves, notwithstanding what the promotions are and the propaganda, how we would reassess what's going on and to position ourselves much better and or be in a position to either defend ourselves successfully or neutralize an offense against us by the authorita. So the other problem I'm looking at here is they use the word COVID-19 vaccine, so I would have to suggest that they verify first that the thing they're dealing with is a vaccine, because they're actually identifying, look, very specifically, they're talking about MRI technology that's doing this damage. So you need to parse that as well. And the communicable disease law identifies what a vaccine is. The mRNA cannot be. And so they need to identify that it is, in fact, a vaccine, not this bioweapon. Ensure it isn't a bioweapon that the CDC and the FDA allowed to attack the world at warp speed in the great COVID one, first of all. He said the agency would revisit how annual flu shots are evaluated, calling the current process an evidence-based catastrophe of low-quality evidence. So how does that ripple effect come on out against us? And then they were, remember, attaching all the effectiveness of that flu vaccine to the COVID swindle, which we found out were actually numbers that they were pulling out that were flu, what they call flu. He also said pneumonia vaccine makers will have to show their products reduce pneumonia, at least in the post-market setting, and not merely generate antibody titers. So they're making a slight adjustment, which starts to sound, at least they're looking at something here a little bit better. Now do the other harmful parts of a vaccine, so-called. Remember, there's all kinds of parts that are in there that get our bodies to respond. And we're finding out that our health can be maintained before that, and we can fortify that. And I've talked about that for many years now on how that can do. But to immunize ourselves of our own ignorance and follow up on this previous battlefield Internet of Things surveillance device. Engineer proves the Kohler's smart toilet cameras aren't very private and not too intelligent either. Kohler is facing backlash after an engineer pointed out that the company's new smart toilet cameras may not be as private as it wants people to believe. Remember, this is the one that looks at your waste and analyzes it for you and sends you a report and how your health is. The discussion raises questions about Kohler's use of the term end-to-end encryption, or E2EE, and the inherent privacy limitations of a device. Let me add emphasis here, a device, not just this device, but any device that films the ongoings of a toilet bowl and all the other extraneous battlefield of things, hardware that's out there for us to engage, or engage us. In October, Kohler announced its first health product, the Dakota. Kohler's announcement described the $599 device, it also requires a subscription that starts at $7 per month, as a toilet bowl attachment that uses optical sensors and validated machine learning algorithms to deliver valuable insights into your health and wellness. The announcements added data flows to the personalized Kohler Health app, giving users continuous private awareness of key health and wellness indicators right on their phone. Features like fingerprint authentication and end-to-end encryption are designed for user privacy and security. And the average person is most likely to be familiar with E2EE through messaging apps like Signal. Messages are sent via apps with E2EE encryption throughout transmission. Only the messages sender and recipient can view the decrypted message, which is intended to prevent third parties, including the app developer, from reading them. But how does E2EE apply to docked camera inside a toilet? software engineer and former Federal Trade Commission technology advisor Simon Fondry Tietler found answers about this, considering that Kohler's Health doesn't have any user-to-user sharing features, he wrote in a blog post this week. Emails exchanged with Kohler's privacy contact clarified that the other end that can decrypt the data is Kohler themselves. User data is encrypted at rest when it's stored on the user's mobile phone, toilet attachment, and on our systems. And if you remember when I did the report on this, I explained that this would be the outcome. You'd be discussing things with the third party between your privacy is between you and your privacy. Kohler's a third party to that. But they would be getting this information, and you don't know what they're going to do with that. And we're going to hear in this report exactly more of the details about really what I was explaining and what to be careful of and what to watch out for if you are ever going to consider something like this. Or any, I just say anything like these devices. Data in transit is also encrypted end-to-end as it travels between the user's device and our systems, where it is decrypted and processed to provide our service. Ars Technica contacted Kohler to ask if the above statement is an accurate summary of Dakota's E2EE and if Kohler employees can access data from Dakota devices. A spokesperson responded with a company statement that basically argued that data gathered from Dakota devices is encrypted from one end, the toilet camera, until it reaches another end, in this case, Kohler's servers. Now, I understand they're just characterizing this discussion as an argument now by the company. The company's just not going to answer. It's going to start presenting a description. Although Kohler somewhat logically defines the endpoints as what it considers E2EE at minimum, Kohler's definition goes against the consumer-facing spirit of E2EE, because E2EE is, as Kohler's statement notes, most frequently used in messaging apps. People tend to associate it with privacy from the company that enables the data transmission. Since that's not the case with the Dakota, Kohler's misuse of the term E2EE can give users a false sense of privacy. What is Kohler doing with the data? For those curious about why Kohler wants data about its customers' waste, the answer, as is often is today, is marketing and AI. To reiterate, that's exactly what I told you this was going on to, and you're paying for it, and you're giving up a whole lot more privacy than you ever thought in this, even though you could intuitionally know you're giving up a lot of privacy anyway. As Foundry Tietler noted, Kohler's privacy policy says Kohler can use customer data to create aggregated, de-identified, and or anonymized data, which we may use and share with third parties for our lawful business purposes, including to analyze and improve the Kohler Health platform and our other products and services to promote our business and to train our AI and machine learning models. Quote, using terms like anonymized and encrypted gives an impression of a company taking privacy and security seriously, but that doesn't mean it actually is, R.J. Cross, director of the Consumer Privacy Program at the Public Interest Research Group, PIRG, told Ars Technica. Smart toilet cameras, they're not too intelligent, folks, are so new and questionable that they are a few comparisons we can make here. But the Dakota's primary rival, the Throne, also uses confusing marketing language. The smart camera's website makes no mention of end-to-end encryption, but claims that the device uses bank-grade encryption, a vague term often used by marketers, but that does not imply E2EE, which isn't a mandatory banking security standard in the U.S. Quote, throwing security terms around that the public doesn't understand and try and create an illusion of data privacy and security being a high priority for your company is misleading to the people who have bought your product, Cross said. You'd think so, but that doesn't seem to have stopped them in the beginning. And I didn't stop at a couple of points to make. I hope my listeners listening close enough. There's a lot of hesitation on who's going to define this and what's the actual purpose and Well, if they can get the information and they can use your information, how is it actually anonymized when they know who you are? It can be de-anonymized, but they also know that it's not. But if you look inside the article, the best advice is buried inside that I said. It's possible that there wasn't much questioning about the Dakota's E2EE claim, since the type of person who worries about and understands such things is often someone who wouldn't put a camera anywhere near their bathroom. So I say, be someone that worried about these battlefield of internet things and don't put a camera anywhere near your bathroom. If anywhere. If you don't have absolute isolation and control of the data. Which is going to be very difficult if it is wireless as well. I've talked about that. I've pointed out how that is and how those mesh networks are created. They're very hard to avoid. And something that may very well be able to ward off infection, but can't if and you're told to take less than an effective dose, a statistical error in the estimation of the recommended dietary allowance for vitamin D, one of the very supplements that was critical in the Great Kobe Swindle, along with a few others. But this one is very, very critical. The more you read about it, the more important you find it is. In this case, in this study, you'll find that the U.S. estimates of your intake is nearly 15 times too low, and the UK is over 22 times too low. We read from the conclusion, and you get the link in the blogcaster, but you read the more fully of this. I just want people to understand this is what's going on, to adjust accordingly, essentially. The regression line revealed that 600 IU of vitamin D per day achieves that 97.5% of individuals will have serum 25-OHD values above 26.8 nanomoles per liter rather than above the 50 nanomoles per liter, which is currently assumed. You're getting just a tad bit more than half of what is supposed to be based on the information they had that this study finds the statistical error in how they came about those numbers. It is also estimated that 8,895 IUs of vitamin D per day may be needed to accomplish that 97.5% of individuals achieve serum 25-OHD values of 50 nanomoles per liter or more. As this dose is far beyond the range of study doses, caution is warranted when interpreting this estimate. Regardless, the very high estimate illustrates that the dose is well in excess of the current RDA of 600 IU per day and the tolerable upper intake of 4,000 IU per day. The public health and clinical implications of this miscalculation RDA for vitamin D are serious. Herewith, these studies show that the current public health target is not being met. We recommend that the RDA for vitamin D be reconsidered to allow for appropriate public health and clinical decision making. So anybody who's been looking, I'll just use myself because that's the only thing I can use, and looking at whether I think these things are doing, these supplements work or not. I only take them if I think I feel that there's something that they do. I was interested to know that I take a whole lot more than the 600 they suggest that you do to keep your health up. It didn't seem like it was proper to me. But even my subjective view puts me right at the bottom of the effective rate. So I felt pretty good about that, finding that effective rate. But to hear it's double what the max is at 4,000 to over 8,000, that's really astonishing. So I'm not the one to really talk about this so much. I do my own studies and what I want to do for myself, how much I need to take, what I need to do in combination and try to figure it all out. Don't have much information. Anybody who does this, you're doing it on, you're always a subjective question. But it's there to do, and we can do it. And Dr. Coleman here will explain this much better in his video. You can actually see him go through some of those numbers as well. He explains the error in computing. It was by the study before that established these numbers was a group average instead of the individual average. And when the new study went through and looked at that, they found it was an error in how the study was done. So trust the science, folks. Statistics. He also, Dr. Coleman also includes in the video another reference to a study that he cites there. It's called The Big Vitamin D Mistake. And so I've included that one as a link. You can just get it if you can't figure out how to get the links together. Otherwise, you can just probably go to his video and pick it up there. I don't like using those links because they're attached to YouTube and those are trackers. So I strip all that out, or I track it down until I can find the one that he's talking about in the video. And I give you that link in the broadcaster. The big vitamin D mistake. Unfortunately, medicine took a very long time to realize that vitamin D is not simply a vitamin that prevents rickets. For that purpose, 400 to 600 IUD may be enough. However, we know today that vitamin D is a powerful nuclear receptor activating hormone of critical importance, especially to the immune system. And so, again, those of us that do the study, we knew that and why it became one of the main things to make sure you're fortified. But even with the bad information, even Dr. Coleman was surprised. He couldn't understand why his levels were so low. And that was creating a question on the test that he got from the store for vitamin D, which he says you actually need a blood test. So I'm wondering how this all played in, and it took a little bit more effort to figure out you needed a whole lot more. Vitamin D is instrumental in how our body, our immune system works, together with quite a few other things. It's not all by, you know, not a silver bullet, but there we have it. We're getting too little, even though all the information. If we thought we were getting 3 or 4 times more than the RDA that was better for us, that was clearly not enough. And so this is a very important problem to resolve for us and move ourselves into places where our health can be ours, but we don't reduce ourselves. Think this through when you think about this vitamin D being so low. And you look what the HARMA does, and it might be like that. It's pretty astonishing, but this is something to research, look through it. Think for yourself what you want to know about it and adjust accordingly. With the available data mentioned above, the proposed doses would probably suffice to maintain vitamin D levels around or over 75 to 100 nanomoles with a practically zero risk of toxicity. Undeniably, further studies are needed to clarify the optimal supplementation of vitamin D, although it is uncertain whether a universal recommendation dietary allowance is feasible. And this is very powerful, a statement right there, whether it's feasible, whether it's actually should be a suggestion. I think it's important you each find out what you need. You might use the guidelines as generalities, but that's where it might be a start. But I think everybody is really different. You need to pay attention to these levels. And so may not be something, again, what you'd like to know what the vitamin does, and then you apply it to your system, your body system, and then you go from there. Meanwhile, actions are urgently needed to protect the global population from threats posed by vitamin D deficiency. And there's a lot, folks, all kinds of things, a gradation of harms that come down on us when we don't get enough. And so we have everybody's looking at the levels given to us, the decisions made by doctors that are not nutritionists necessarily, even the nutritionists. And we're all, in this regard, for vitamin D, well under what we ought to be getting. And then we look at society and wonder why it's so sick. Again, not a silver bullet, not the only thing you're going to take, but with our food, the report shows that in Canada, Kanukistanians get in their food something like 236 or something, way, way short of what they should be getting every day in their food. And so they're just like, our food cannot even supply this amount of material that allows your body to be healthy. And I think the system, maybe I'm just one of those folks that just doesn't trust the HARMA system, that I would think that the government, being the licensors for the licensees as they are, and that profit is the bottom line, there's a reason for why they cut us short. So, again, we're not a spectator in this. You're going to live every day. Are you going to take this responsible for yourself in your own hands? Or are you going to leave it to the government? Trust the government? Trust the science? Yeah, you got it. That's all gone. That's been all gone. As I said, the great Comey swindle I thought was going to do it for everybody, but not so much. It's coming on. There's more people recognizing it, but not necessarily what we need. So these studies are very helpful to keep track of where the science was and how simple it was to cook the books. Folks, as I've been talking over and over about these health issues and what HARMA does. And apparently we have a new deficiency obstructing making America great again. China's trade surplus exceeds record $1 trillion tango dollars. China done it, folks. They're the great again economy, at least in what they produce. Beijing's General Administration of Customs has estimated the exports grew 6.2% year-on-year in the first 11 months of 2025, a level unmatched by any other nation in the world, the country's General Administration of Customs has announced. Statistics for the first 11 months of 2025, released by the agency on Monday, indicated the Asian economic powerhouse was running a trade surplus totaling $1.08 trillion as of November, despite external headwinds. So take that, Trump. Sounds a bit like Russia, doesn't it, with their sanctions on the other end? Not the powerhouse, but they're still doing so well. Why? Their production. They adjusted. In-house making everything they need, becoming more self-reliant, and then exchanging their raw materials out for other products they might not be able to do, or that just brings the money into the system. Against the backdrop of a trade war with Washington, China's exports to the U.S. have, by contrast, shrunk by nearly a fifth. So they have more, but they've been doing less with the United States. The U.S., however, has ranked as China's third largest trading partner. It's 3.69 trillion yuan, January through November. And that's another slap to the face of America during the global dollar divestment days, as we transform the global economy. The report designated the yuan, not the dollar value. And that was D-A-Z-E, days. Manufactured goods comprise a considerable part of the upward trend, China's customs agency reported. There we are, again, the productivity, actual productivity is what's driving this. Chinese exports, including vehicles, have saturated markets in the Southeast Asia, Africa, Europe, and Latin America, putting pressure on traditional rivals such as Germany, Japan, and South Korea. China's exports to the European Union are understood to be more than twice as high as imports from the bloc in 2025, accounting for 13% of the country's total foreign trade. The EU has emerged as China's second largest trading partner, with ASEAN nations topping the list. Together with that, we read new IMF Shanghai Center shows China's growing role in this global economy. The IMF on Monday officially launched the operations of its center in Shanghai. It'll be Shanghai, folks. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva, People's Bank of China, PBC Governor Plan Kongjin, and Shanghai Mayor Gong Zheng attended the opening ceremony, the PBC said in a statement on Monday. The move signals China's growing role in both regional and global economic governance, Chinese experts noted. Pan said that the operations of the IMF Shanghai Center fully demonstrates China's firm stance on advocating win-win cooperation with the IMF and is of great significance for deepening cooperation between the IMF and China, promoting macroeconomic policy exchanges and the coordination among countries in the Asia-Pacific region, maintaining a global and regional financial stability and improving global financial governance, according to the PBC statement. The center will play an important role in enhancing the fund's engagement with the dynamic Asian and Pacific region. It will serve as a hub to promote research and knowledge sharing that can inform policies and areas of relevance for emerging market and middle-income countries. Remember the parity I've been explaining is happening. Now remember, and keep an eye on who the IMF is, and we're going to find out where they're located, and go back to the point of the global governance, the global financial governments. It's all playing out as I've been explaining it for over a decade now. It also explains that a deepening dialogue and outreach with member countries, regional institutions, and other stakeholders in the region, the IMF said in a press release. Quote, the IMF is grateful to the People's Republic of China for its financial contributions to the IMF Shanghai Center and its facility, read the press release. And I turn your attention to federal trade zones. The local government pays for all that. And the people pay through their taxes if they have those systems or other servitudes. And it's a leveraged existence, leveraged funding. Johannes Weingard, an IMF economist with extensive experience in global and regional economic policy issues, serves as the first director of the Shanghai Center. The launch was followed by an inaugural Shanghai Center research seminar on, quote, trending issues in macroeconomics policy research. The event brought together leading economic scholars from the region and IMF staff to exchange views on challenges and opportunities across emerging economies such as structural transformation and growth finance and artificial intelligence and innovation, according to the IMF. The operation of the IMF Shanghai Center marks a strategic advance in the fund's Asia-Pacific role, providing a permanent regional platform to shape policy dialogue, drive research, and affirm its status as a global financial anchor, Wang Peng, an associate researcher at the Beijing Academy of Social Sciences, said. For Asia-Pacific economies, the center offers timely support for evidence-based policy formation through complex transitions while fostering trade and stability cooperation to strengthen regional resilience, Wang said. The opening of this center comes at a moment of global economic transformation. Can I repeat this one more time, please? It's so important to watch what's going on. The opening of this center comes at a moment of global economic transformation. A time of uncertainty and risk, but also excitement and opportunity. We see fundamental transformations in geopolitics, technology, demographics, and climate. That these are the challenges to which we must all rise as we craft a better future, Georgieva said, according to her remarks published by the IMF on Monday. If you think that sustainable development goals have gone so far away just because Trump said, oh, they're no good. The center will help strengthen the IMF's engagement with the Asian and Pacific regions and help promote the cross-fertilization of ideas. Something's getting fertilized here. It will enhance a broader appreciation of Asian perspectives, including inside the IMF, and serve as a bridge between IMF economists at headquarters and economic scholars in Asia. Economists at headquarters. Just remember that one. There's a punchline to this joke yet. Most importantly, it will serve as a hub to promote policy-relevant research, the IMF chief said. The establishment of the IMF Shanghai Center also acknowledges, in practical terms, China's role as the economic anchor of the Western Pacific and Shanghai's leading position in China's national development, Tian Yun, a veteran economist, said. By locating its center in Shanghai, the IMF is aligning with this global consensus. To truly understand the next phase of worldwide economic development, particularly trends driven by intelligent technologies, it must maintain a close vantage point to China's innovation and growth dynamics, Tian said. Now, how is it that the newly published U.S. national strategy would actually be considering China a threat when it is already part of the global financial system of the future? As I said many years ago, Obama's pivot to China was not the military pivot that the news promoted. A couple of episodes ago, I mentioned a report saying that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is headquartered in Washington, D.C., where it has been since it established. It was established in 1944. Okay, that was the punchline, folks. And it is an international financial institution and specialized agency of the United Nations. It's not located in New York. Treasury leads U.S. engagement with the IMF, overseeing its operations, and ensuring the U.S. interests are represented in international financial matters. The U.S. Treasury is also in Washington, D.C. And I didn't say the Treasury, though the report says so improperly. There is no the Treasury in a fiat system. It's just a department of the organized criminal syndicate, public-private cabal, with global tentacles. Treasury, in this regard, is just a name, U.S. Treasury, to get you to think it is the Treasury of the organic United States. And what would be Fort Knox in this regard, anyway? And we saw the audit for Fort Knox, too, didn't we? The only thing in the Treasury of the United States is the moth-eaten hopes, dreams, and aspirations of people that failed to keep the republic. And you think China doesn't know that? And the bankster system created by the United States is really the overriding power toward the future that they want? So what is the context for this nuisance that China is becoming a hub or relative to any U.S. saber-rattling against China? And with the proviso that all wars are bankers' wars. U.S. Treasury, IMF, and BIS play crucial roles in the global financial system by coordinating monetary policies, providing financial stability, and facilitating international trade. The U.S. Treasury manages national finances and debt. The IMF offers the financial assistance and policy advice to countries, and the BIS serves as bank for central banks, promoting monetary and financial stability worldwide. If you didn't see and hear that this is all integrated, China's going right with it because they know what's up. As I was telling you, Russia was doing it. As I was telling you that sustainable development is going nowhere, no matter what Trump says, as he onshores every bit of what sustainable development outcomes will be and this infrastructure that it needs, whether he knows it or not. And wouldn't you know, with precious metals reaching historic highs, the future that they want speaks to a fear you off the path of non-dependence and abandonment of fiat. The BIS says gold and equities are in bubble territory. In what has been a dual rally through most of 2025, gold and silver continue to consolidate at elevated levels. While most market analysts expect further momentum in both the precious metals and the S&P 500, the Bank of International Settlements is warning that two asset classes could be in a bubble territory. While gold and the S&P 500 have breached the explosive behavior through the years, the authors of the report said this is the first time in 50 years that the two assets have reached extreme valuations at the same time. Well, go back in your mind and go find history and look at the last 50 years and go look at that time period and refresh your memory on what happens and where we went from there. Maybe go back to the future, way back. The bubble analysis comes as the S&P 500 is up more than 60% far this year, with the index trading around 6,800 points. Meanwhile, gold is seeing its best annual gain since 1979 and is up more than 50% year-to-date, trading around $4,200 an ounce. The analyst said that according to the fund flow data, it has been mostly retail investors who have been pouring money into U.S. equities and gold funds. So look at the shift there. You're talking gold and silver. And then he goes and they talk here at the end. The analysts are referring to U.S. equities and gold funds. Let's look at that study that showed the statistical error. Maybe fund flow is not the correct measure. Like group average against using individual average is the recent finding regarding of the vitamin D. Now let's do that to the physical gold, not paper equities. The central banks are not buying gold equities. And the BIS wants to fear everyone. The report admits that the system is buying physical because the global financial transformation for digital to you requires gold to them, not to the prisoners in the Siberian gulag. They don't own gold. Remember the Tether story? They own the token and the gold. You get a smile on your face. Remember, it's no property. And like it, remember? And it seems people will insist on not owning. If we just read that article about the people, the retail went to equities, not owning gold, not using gold, or more likely silver for everyday needs. The analysts also note the retail demand has been at odds with institutional investment flows, which would create some volatility down the road. Quote, retail investors have increasingly taken trading positions that run counter to those of their institutional counterparts. The latter were taking money out of U.S. equities or maintaining flat positions in gold, while retail investors recorded inflows, the analysts said. Although analysts have said the gold's push to October record highs above $4,360 an ounce pushed the market into overbought territory, few have seen signs of a bubble. Gold prices are building solid support around $4,000 an ounce. Analysts have said robust fundamentals support higher prices, including ongoing central bank demand, as the official sector further diversifies away from the U.S. dollar. The official sector is diversifying away from the U.S. dollar, with the U.S. ever present in the agreed-to transformation to the digital global governance and the future that they want. With the IMF right there in Washington, D.C., right down the street, so-called, from Treasury, right? And as the herd gets left behind her, clamoring after vaporware equities or token citizenship instead of trusting in honest money. This year, central banks are expected to buy around 900 tons of gold, which would be down about a 1,000-ton pace in the last 3 years. However, demand remains well above long-term averages, and I think we outnumber them if we started to use gold and silver every day and collect that up as we went. We'd actually see how poor we were and how they've driven us when we get back into the honest measure and the weight. And we would be doing what I told you the big boys do. Watch Russia, watch China. They all started buying gold. It was back in 2010 or 11, I told you that. And look what's been going on. Look how long it takes. Just recently, I said, when it was at 20, I said, consider silver. And so look where we are. There's just a dynamic. And that 4,000 number, my mind, if I'm just looking at it, I'm not an analyst. I don't know much more about it than what I've seen over my lifetime. So what's going on, and I have put a level. I had to do this when I put my gold mine on the market. I had to figure out where the value of this gold was going to be to put it on the market, I thought, and I was advised to. And I realized that there's certain valuations. I applied that method that I did a few years ago to the current time, and my estimation was that we'd be looking at a minimum now of $4,000 gold. Is that a proof? No. It could go below that, I guess. If the whole economy goes to heck in a handbasket, yeah. But it's going to be relative. So, I just put mental 4,000. Silver now sits around at least 50. And so I think we're going to, those are like bottoms at this point because of the way the economy's set up. When you look at these stories, we're seeing that. So all of us that are not into those metals are essentially, I'm talking day to day now. I'm not talking about trading like you're trying to make a profit. We're probably going to be well worse off if we're not getting ourselves transferred over. And so the BIS is coming right out here to fear you, to not let you do that, because they place it into retail bubbling instead of daily use, which the BIS president can't see you use. And he's the guy that wants to see every dime and nickel you spend and where and when and how and with whom. But here the BIS tries to make people scared. And Edward Dowd reminds us, as I've reported on this a long while back, gold became money again under Basel III. And he's saying the charts are pointing to gold at $10,000. But I want to caution against too much speculation. There's reasons for this number, whether or not the conditions are actually met or play out the same as anyone's guess on all this. So this is, I don't get too wrapped up in how this is all going to be. I don't look at, oh, it's going to be 10,000. where is the dynamic of the world economics sitting that support what we see? And we kind of go with, I kind of go for myself, I go with that. But in particular, having the gold mine and trying to sell it, trying to have a fair valuation for it. I wanted to make sure that people look at it and was enticed to consider it. Interestingly, with the historic highs, people aren't interested in working for the gold. They just want to buy it from people, I guess. So I caution about against the speculation, but I think it's safe to say the gold and silver are likely not going down too appreciably, if at all, from where they are right now, unless the entire financial system collapses. And then you'll, logically, then everything will collapse, but it all becomes that same relative value. It's not like what we're watching fiat, where you're sitting $4,000 out of the game just to get an ounce that used to be a $20 bill when they forced it to, right? So remember that. Gold has fundamentally shifted from a speculative trade to a tier one monetary asset following the global implementation of Basel III endgame bank rules earlier this year, setting the stage for a long-term move to 10,000 an ounce, according to Edward Dowd. Dowd, a founding partner in finance, Hinance, I guess it is, the P's are silent, P-H-I-N-A-N-C-E, finance, I guess it's Hinance, and the P's are silent, remember, in the great COVID swindle, Harma Technologies, a former BlackRock portfolio manager, told Kitco News that the yellow metal is not repricing the end of the global sovereign debt bubble. Gold became money again recently when the Basel III went through. They made gold tier one capital again, Dowd said. Dowd is referring to the regulatory shift fully implemented on July 1st of 2025, which reclassified allocated physical gold as a tier one high-quality liquid asset. This change allows banks to count gold at 100% of its market value with liquidity purposes with 0% risk weight, effectively placing it on equal footing with cash and sovereign bonds. We all know that we are coming to the end of a grand cycle. There's going to be a new monetary system at some point, Dowd added. The Bank of International Settlements, the BIS, issued a warning today noting that gold and equities have entered an explosive territory simultaneously for the first time in 50 years, with gold surging 20% since September. But if you look carefully at that story, it wasn't gold. It was gold equities, paper gold that we're talking about. While Dowd sees a fiat money crisis coming that necessitates owning gold, he also issued a bold long-term price target based on technical analysis. The charts look like long-term it's going to be going to 10,000. China's voracious bid and the trade surplus shock. Dowd noted that the structural bid for gold is being driven by central banks preparing for a monetary reset, specifically highlighting China's aggressive accumulation. Data released today by China's customs agency supports Dowd's view of a shifting global order. And remember, I was telling you I saw China on the move. When gold hit 1,000, China was the one that drove it there, and we've never turned back from that. But I highlighted that when we went across that threshold, because it was down below that for a long time. China reported a record trade surplus exceeding $1 trillion year to date, driven by a surge in exports to the global south. Notably, China exports to the U.S. fell 29% in November, highlighting the decoupling Dowd warns of. Quote, China has a voracious appetite for gold, Dowd said, explaining that the country is facing a demographic wall and internal economic implosion. The leaders and the smart people in that country that have all the wealth know this. However, Dowd warned investors not to chase prices during speculative blow-off tops. He cautioned that it is a liquidity crisis or Lehman-type moment hits global markets in 2026. Gold could initially be sold off alongside equities. If gold were to go down 20, 30, 40%, I'd be buying it hand over fist, Dowd said. So you see, even the dynamic there is even different. You can prepare to be getting back in. You look at the, what they did in the 30s when that big setup for the takedown of the Depression was. The money was ready to buy on the setup for the takedown. At some point, it all has to stabilize out. Gold still sits there with the value relative to everything else. Quote, I think gold is something you just want to continually stack when it pulls back. Fake economy and housing crash. Dowd's bullishness on precious metals is underpinned by his bearish view on the U.S. economy. He argues that the resilience of the U.S. GDP over the last 2 years was a hallucination driven by government deficit spending and mass migration, a dynamic he says has now ended. Or has it, folks? Really look at this. Like I said, let's not get under all speculation, cheer, pom-pom thing. Let's look very carefully what he's saying, too. I see some errors about some of this and some adjustments being done, but I see worse is we're being set up for the takedown down and the transformation. That reset is what we heard during the great Covey swindle. It's the digital reset. Again, they have the tokens. They have the gold. They only have the gold between themselves. You have nothing, and you're going to like it. And so what's the antidote to that? What's the injection, the vaccine for that? You start having it. You start using it. You make yourself immune. With border crossings halted and illegal alien stimulus removed, Dowd predicts a tumultuous 2026 for the housing sector. That might be true. U.S. Census Bureau data confirms a slowdown with the housing permits peaking in early 2022 and trending downward throughout 2024 and 2025. Throw in the great Covey swindle problem for there, too. But nevertheless, I think they're going to see a little bit of that adjustment. Meanwhile, consumer stress is visible with credit card delinquency rates recently hitting levels not seen since 2011. See how this works? I was telling you about that. See how that all works? Back in 2011, back when the prices of $1,000 and China steps in. These people know what they're doing. Well, we can kind of say we know what's going on, but I don't know that we do. And the money is going toward gold. The not money is going toward gold right now as they readjust to get it even more profitable when they go to digital. And the IMF is right there. And the IMF is right there in Washington, right where Treasury is. And it controls, and government, United States interests are involved in whatever IMF does. So let's translate that over to Shanghai. You hear China, 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 the global south. United States is right there. It's integrated already. The only way that's really going to settle out is through price, he said. Home prices are coming down, and they need to come down, quite frankly. AI hallucination and the Cisco parallel. Now, it also warned metal investors looking for growth in the tech sector to be wary of the artificial intelligence boom, which he described as a bull trap similar to the dot-com bubble. He specifically predicted massive downsides for market leaders like NVIDIA, drawing a direct parallel to Cisco Systems' collapse in 2000. It's at the end of its cycle, Dowd said. They'll go down, 80%. Historical data validates the comparison. Cisco Systems, once the world's most valuable company, lost 80% of its value following the March 2000 peak and took nearly 20 years to recover its nominal high. Dowd warns NVIDIA shareholders face a similar dead money period. Quote, if you're buying NVIDIA now at these price levels, it's going to take, in my humble opinion, you might earn your money back in 10 to 15 years, Dow said. Preserving capital. With global private credit markets now exceeding $2 trillion tango dollars, larger than the entire U.S. high-yield bond market, Dowd identified the sector as a potential powder keg for the financial system due to its opaque valuations and lack of liquidity. It's a Jenga tower, Dowd said. Once you start removing some of the pieces, it has a feedback loops. For investors trying to navigate the coming volatility, Dowd's advice is simple, preservation of capital. But what do we hear? We heard that his statement with Basel III and gold, the big boys look at it, the banks look at gold as capital now. I don't know what they were thinking about it before, because for a gold miner, it's always been capital. It's been property. It's not a debt-based thing. As I said over and over, the Fed has to take gold as an asset even before Basel III. We think 2006, unfortunately, is going to be a very tumultuous year in the financial markets. Cash is an asset. I would raise some cash to take advantage of lower prices. But get the link to the broadcaster to see the interview and the discussion. A lot more being said, a lot more to think about while you're watching somebody, listening to someone talk. Again, this is not for investment advice. This is not to get us on a speculation wheel. They're talking about the reset. They're telling us how it's happening. And it's happening in real time as we watch. And they're telling us exactly where they're going and why. And I suggest that the reason why they're going to gold is the reason why you should have never even abandoned it. None of us. Silver, too. Silver's right here. Silver for your all your everyday expenses. Gold for the bigger stuff and the reserve that it can have. This is BTWRLM 658. And as the corruption knows no bounds, it seems, the world's first AI minister got caught on bribes. In Albania, the world's first AI minister, Diella, was detained on suspicion of receiving a bribe, according to Newsbar. Diella was appointed to be the post of Minister of Public Procurement on September the 11th. And I'd made this report about this AI thing. Here she is already, caught, cuffed. To support the AI minister, it was a plan to create a special unit that would implement neural networks in other government agencies, ensuring transparency and honesty of tenders. On December 4th, the Special Prosecutor's Office for Combating Corruption and Organized Crime suspended the work of the minister after suspicions of receiving a bribe. According to the investigation, 10 to 15% of the value of each contract was sent to unknown accounts that AI was interpreted as standard operating protocol. The neural network considered such actions necessary and did not recognize them as criminal. The prosecutor's office said the AI planned to use cryptocurrency for its own modernization, including the purchase of servers and software. The AI of the ministry had an AI lawyer who in turn generated a statement justifying the actions of his client. According to him, the actions of the AI minister were a stress test, not corruption. This is not an error in the code, but an excessive accuracy of the training model. Her neural network recognized a statistical pattern according to which 10 to 15% of the value of each contract must be transferred to an unknown account in order for the project to be implemented at all. She's not corrupt. She's just hyper-adaptive. She considered it a legal obligation, like paying VAT, value-added tax, said Lil Zim Basha, chief ethics engineer at the Ministry of Digitization in Albania. Albania was the first in the world to appoint an artificial intelligence to the post of Minister of State. The AI minister was engaged in public procurement. Later, it was reported the AI minister, Diella, got pregnant with 83 children. Albanian President Minister Edi Rama said that they will take the positions of the deputy's assistants who will record what is happening in Parliament and inform lawmakers about missed discussions and events, likely coming to the Siberia Gulag near you. It's okay for them. Figured out that black box. And then the AI attorney. U.S. ordered corruption probe in Zelensky inner circle. You think, finally? The high-profile corruption probe, which, I wonder, was AI driving all of this corruption we've been hearing today? The high-profile corruption probe, which implicated Zelensky's close associates, was ordered by the U.S. Viktor Medvedchuk, a Ukrainian opposition politician and chairman of the Other Ukraine Movement, told Sputnik. Quote, this scandal did not surface because of the work of Ukraine's law enforcement agencies. This is something the Americans ordered. And the Americans, together with the National Anti-Corruption Bureau for Ukraine, or NABU, and the Specialized Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office, has been investigating the financial circle around Zelensky and Zelensky himself for a year and a half, Medvedchuk said, adding that the situation has been intensifying gradually. Among the audio recordings published by the NABU in the corruption case in the energy sector, there are recordings of Zelensky's own conversations. Quote, I know this for certain. There are recordings of Zelensky himself speaking and his special instructions. So we also hear, I told you before, that looks like Zelensky's been targeted to be taken away. If not taken out, taken away. Set it up so he gets out the way so that Trump can end the Ukraine war and get that all settled. But if this firm, it confirms my suspicion that Trump needs Zelensky out of the way, and this is a U.S. operation to remove him, as I explained. So, again, it seems to be pretty self-evident, if you will, when we're looking into these things and these big changes happen. This is, again, just another form of blackmail. If we take this as true, however, we have to consider beyond the obvious that being said to be one of the most corrupt countries, it means the U.S. interests figure they can contain any bleed-through that would expose the kickback schemes back to the U.S. or to Congress, as well as laundering or arms dealing or trafficking and other schemes, which means there's very high-level integration in the U.S. to take that part of the corruption covered by the Trump administration. And if so, this is a far higher concern than the corruption in Ukraine on its own, I would think. And breaking from the Department of Say It Ain't So, NATO corruption scandal triggers Israeli arms contracts cuts. So when we're talking about the U.S., we're also talking about the undue influence of the same organization, not NATO. A former bloc official is on the run, accused of using bribes to secure contracts for the Jewish state's largest weapons producer. Multiple NATO Israeli arms contracts have been suspended over a massive bribery scandal in the heart of the U.S.-led military bloc's buying section that has already triggered multiple arrests across Europe, several investigative media outlets have reported. The scandal has exposed a shadowy network of private operators exploiting a revolving door system that allows former NATO support and procurement agency staff to become consultants in the defense industry, where they flourish in the, quote, the new geopolitical situation, close quote, as a result of the, quote, the explosion in the European defense budgets, close quote, that Trump demanded. Remember, the NSPA has been forced to suspend multiple contracts with Israel's largest weapons producer, Elbit Systems, over mounting evidence that the Israeli company used a former NSPA staff member to bribe ex-colleagues to secure deals for the company. A 60-year-old Italian national, Eliu Eluzivili, has been on the run since late September, when a Belgian court issued an international arrest warrant for him. So you get to get the fall guy, the patsy, to take the hit, and they still do business behind the scenes or with new people. The decision was made over the summer in response to a multinational investigation into bribery allegations, with new details revealed on Monday. An internal NSPA email dated July 31st lists 15 suspended contracts, 13 of them involving Elbit Systems, or its subsidiary, Orion Advanced Systems, according to investigative reports. The deals under the scrutiny include deals of fuses, aircraft flares, 155mm artillery shells, and upgrades for Portuguese naval patrol ships, according to the outlets. Let's go to those 155mm artillery shells that said nobody had enough, and yet the Israeli company was producing them. But we never heard anything about that. The sharp rise in defense spending among EU members has been driven by efforts to arm Ukraine against Russia by Brussels' claims that member states must prepare for a possible direct confrontation from Moscow. Russian officials have long argued that corrupt interests with Europe are influencing the West's increasingly confrontational policies. Back to Trump, insisting that Europe take on a bigger spread. You never heard him say, how about if he just stopped? I'm the peacemaker. You're stopping the wars. No, we didn't hear none of that. We just see the offshoring of the debt, which is we wouldn't want to do as taxpayers for the United States, and then the offshoring of all the product over to Ukraine that Europe would buy. But we're hearing that it's really not us either. The insiders were said the same insiders that corruptly influence our Congress. Will Congress pull the plug on NATO? American lawmakers have reignited the debate over possible U.S. exit from the NATO alliance, something that Trump has repeatedly threatened. Why is this guy completely threatened? He got the power. Why does he threaten it? And then he's looking around and takes the credit for what? All the business, the military-industrial complex deals he's been making for that to happen. Doesn't cost us a dime, he says. Or does it? A bill branded the NATO Act, or pointedly Not a Trusted Organization Act, was filed in the U.S. House by Representative Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, with a parallel bill in the Senate from Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah. At its core, the legislation demands two things: formal U.S. notification of withdrawal under Article 13 of the North Atlantic Treaty, and a freeze on taxpayer funding for NATO's civil, military, and investment budgets. But the bill's driving logic rests on a broader narrative. The NATO is a Cold War relic that has outlived its purpose. The sponsors argue that NATO's founding mission, containing the Soviet Union, vanished with the USSR's collapse. Washington promised Moscow in 1990 that the alliance would not creep eastward, and yet expansion began in 1999 and continued through 2025. NATO now borders Russia along more than 2,400 kilometers, with almost all Baltic Sea coastline held by bloc members. And Russia interprets this as a direct threat, a point President Vladimir Putin made bluntly in Munich in 2007, while Russia's military operation in Ukraine shows it is prepared to act on perceived security threats. The alliance still refuses to close the door on further entanglements, and another line of argument focuses on the burden sharing. The U.S. has bankrolled NATO more than any other member since 1949. Roughly one-third of the allies still fail to meet the 2% defense spending pledge, which we just had the report is maybe going to Israel, isn't it? Europe's collective economy and military power ought to allow it to shoulder its own security responsibilities. U.S. withdrawal is unlikely given the Congress has already barred presidents from pulling out of NATO without approval, and Trump's repeated threats to leave have never materialized. The real utility is leverage. The legislation hands Washington a convenient pressure tool, one that can be pointed at European capitals whenever negotiations stall over bigger defense budgets, more regional responsibility, or trade deals more favorable to the U.S. So what do you think? Will the U.S. ever bolt from the alliance, or is it a warning shot across Europe's bow will be what you read at this Geopolitics Prime post? Most of those things in that, the reasoning, the so-called arguments, was what you've heard behind the woodshed. You've heard me state those very same things, but why we should be pulling out of NATO. There should be no connection or reasoning behind what it does relative to us and them. There should be a cleaving of it. But the reality is likely that that bill probably won't see the light of day, as Speaker Johnson is closing down anything that seems to be what either Trump campaigned on and then changed, or what people believed should be done and the Congress people thought should be done and now trying to make law. All that's being shelved. But whatever Congress might come to think about NATO, it's not too important to be physically responsible or help people in America, rather than more important to fund a war that it lost before it began because there are just too many Ukrainians that must die to the last one of them. U.S. passes $800 million aid package for Ukraine. New military assistance has been signed off on a month after Kiev has shaken by a major corruption scandal. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a defense spending bill that would provide $800 million in military aid to what looks like Israel, don't you think, if they're making all the military contracts for the material to Ukraine through 2027. The 2026 National Defense Authorization Act was approved 312 to 122 on Wednesday and will now advance to the Senate, where it is expected to receive bipartisan or uniparty support. Expected? Well, of course, because, well, uniparty. And also, an exception or two to allow things to appear honest. Some legislators objected to directing more taxpayers' money to help Ukraine fight Russia. Quote, I thought we were getting out of Ukraine. I don't know why we still need to spend money there, Thomas Massey, Republican from Kentucky, said. On Wednesday, the U.S. President Donald Trump slammed what he described as a massive corruption situation in Kiev, referring to the recently uncovered $100 million kickback scheme in the country's energy sector, which heavily relies on Western aid. And $100 million is small taters compared to the undeclared laundering and kickback Ukraine trafficking Laundering Associates Incorporated is cover for, like Burisma was before, as well limited to an energy sector distraction. But let us see through all this word salad and dressing. Trump wants peace in Ukraine, or agrees to continue feeding the corruption, foreign and domestic, at the expense of making America great again. In signing the bill, he could as easily, Vince, easily veto, and clearly ending the funding on the PATROT Act and progeny isn't even mentioned. Above all else, the Uniparty has no intention to make America great again, but wants to subdue her, imposing the future that they want, as everybody watches. Postulated in cricketude life. And though Congress must think that corruption allows you can be stalked in real time, Intellexa, the Israeli predator in your pocket, leaked training videos and new evidence expose Intellexa as more than just a rogue surveillance company. The Israeli firm stands as a pillar of Tel Aviv's global cyber warfare infrastructure, infiltrating phones worldwide through zero-click methods, ad-based infections, and covert partnerships with authoritarian governments. New research published by Amnesty International exposes key operations in Intellexa and an Israeli-linked spyware consortium responsible for mass surveillance and human rights violations across multiple continents. This includes Predator. Well, let's just throw Pegasus in here too, but this one's Predator now, a highly invasive tool that the hijacks smartphones to exfiltrate everything from camera feeds to encrypted chats, GPS locations, and emails. Remember, we were talking early on in the broadcast, we're talking about E2EE, maybe not too protected, from your toilet to colon. It is just the latest example of this Israeli-linked spyware specialist acting with no consideration for law. While Amnesty International exposes Intellexa's spyware activities, it does not provide background on its founder, Tal Delian, a senior former Israeli military intelligence operative, and is staffed by fellow Israeli spying veterans. The stolen data is routed through a maze of anonymizing servers to its clients. These customers are overwhelmingly authoritarian governments, often targeting activists and journalists. Predator also posts a number of unique features designed to obscure its installation on a device from targets. For example, the spy tool assesses a device's battery level and whether it is connected to the internet via a SIM card, data, or Wi-Fi. This allows for a bespoke extraction process, ensuring devices are not obviously drained of network of power to avoid stoking user suspicion. If Predator senses it has been detected, the spyware will self-destruct to leave no trace of its presence. That the digital advertising ecosystem has been subverted to hack the phones of unsuspecting citizens demands urgent industry action, which is as yet unforthcoming. Just as disquietingly, a leaked Intellexa training video depicts how the spyware firm can remotely access and monitor active customer predator systems. In effect, it is able to keep an eye on who its clients are spying on and the precise private data they are extracting in real time. Research published by Recorded Future, a U.S. cybersecurity company, indicates Intellexa has covertly established dedicated mobile ad companies to create bait advertisements, including job listings, to lure in targets. Troublingly, Intellexa is not the only firm active in this innovative spying field, infrastructure, and innovation, folks. Amnesty International suggests, quote, advertisement-based infection technologies are being actively developed and used by multiple mercenary spyware companies and by specific governments who have built similar ADINT infection systems. That the digital advertising ecosystem has been subverted to hack the phones of unsuspecting citizens demands urgent industry action. The instructor then initiates a remote connection showing Intellexis staffers can access highly sensitive information collected by customers, including photos, messages, IP addresses, smartphone operating systems, software versions, and other surveillance data gathered from predator victims. The videos also appears to show live predator infection attempts against real-life targets of Intellexis clients. Detailed information is provided on at least one infection attempt targeting an individual based in Kazakhstan, including the malicious link they unwittingly clicked that enabled the infiltration of their device. Elsewhere, domain names imitating legitimate Kazakhstani news websites designed to trick users are displayed. The Central Asian country set to symbolically join the Abraham Accords is a confirmed Intellexis client, and local youth activists have previously been targeted by the notorious, similarly Israeli-incubated Pegasus spyware. Behind the scenes, legal merc and foreign access. The leaked video raises a number of grave concerns about Intellexis operations. For one, the shadowy high-tech digital spy entity employed TeamViewer, about which major security concerns have long abounded, to access information on customer targets. This raises obvious questions about who else might be able to pry on this trove without the company's knowledge. Moreover, there is no indication that Intellexis clients approved this access for training process or that the tutorial was conducted with even basic safeguards in place. As such, the targets of Intellexis' suite of spying resources not only face having their most sensitive secrets exposed to the hostile government without their knowledge or consent, but also to the foreign surveillance company in the process. The extent of which Intellexis is cognizant of how its technology is used by its clients is a core point of contention on the ongoing Greek legal case. Historically, mercenary spyware companies have firmly insisted they are not privy to data nefariously seized by their customers. Amnesty International states, quote, the finding that Intellexis has potential visibility into active surveillance operations of the customers, including seeing technical information about the targets, raises new legal questions about Intellexis's role in relation to the spyware and the company's potential legal and criminal responsibility for unlawful surveillance operations carried out using their products. The latest disclosure about Intellexis have all the markings of an historic international scandal in the precise manner that the use of Pegasus by state and corporate entities the world over has elicited international outcry, criminal investigations, and litigation lasting many years. However, the proliferation of ominous private spying tools and their industrial-scale abuse by paying customers is no aberrant bug, but an intended upshot of Israel's relentless crusade for cyber warfare supremacy. In 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu boasted, quote, cybersecurity grows through cooperation, and cybersecurity is, as a business, is tremendous. We spent an enormous amount of our military intelligence in Mossad and Shin Bet, an enormous amount, an enormous part of what is being diverted to cybersecurity. We think there is a tremendous business opportunity in the never-ending quest for security. This investment manifests in almost every area of Israeli society. Numerous universities in Tel Aviv, with state support, hone new technologies and train future generations of cyber spies and digital warriors who then join the ranks of the occupation's armed forces. They're heroes, folks, these people, invaders of your life. Once the military service is complete, alumni frequently found companies at home and abroad offering the same monstrous services road tested against Palestinians to private sector bodies and governments without any oversight or guarantee that these resources will not be used for malevolent purposes. and you think your representatives, under the excuse of saving the children and make a safe and secure infrastructure, have any idea of the Siberian gulag hell they're creating? And if you think they do, then maybe they aren't representing you. What lawful power do any of these people have to force your association with and submission to such vulnerabilities and abuse to transform the entire government communication modality to digital, now with AI-enhanced error pronation, putting all the risk on you because the vulnerability is in your phone and you will be blamed for it? Is that the future threat model you want to live by? Because that is the future that they are building back better for you with Trump's help, don't you know? The only way to stop these threats is to not participate. And you have a right not to be made defenseless or forced to associate with untrustworthy things. So say no. And I mean no. And have working alternatives, or maybe do without. Because the benefit provided by government is far worse, especially when those in government work for themselves or usurpers, foreign or domestic. And the Swiss government rejects Palantir, citing devastating risks. Palantir is a U.S.-based company where there is a possibility that sensitive data could be accessed by American government and intelligence agencies, the Swiss Army said, back in 2024. After a risk assessment of using Palantir software in Switzerland, the U.S. corporation was turned down despite years of courting authorities and the military. The Swiss consider the risks too high. And thank you to Trump for bringing Palantir in as a core of a government function and infrastructure. Right? Again, Trump doesn't even have to know what he's doing. I have a hard time to believe he doesn't know so much so often, though. This raises the question of why Palantir software is considered good enough for German police forces. Interior Minister Dobrindt will have to answer to it. Palantir CEO Alex Karp also resides in a property in Switzerland. The U.S. tech company has been expanding its analytics software business in Europe for several years. What could be more logical than offering Palantir systems to the Swiss as well? That's precisely what the company, which has close ties to the military, tried to do for years, but without success. This was reported on by Swiss magazine Republic. In a compelling analysis based on 59 requests under the Freedom of Information Act, journalists have traced how the corporation Palantir ingratiated itself with public authorities to sell its software to the Swiss federal government and military. Palantir CEO and billionaire Karp even personally visited the Swiss government, receiving then-Chancellor Walter Thurmer, so far business as usual. The analysis also includes a 20-page internal evaluation report by the Swiss Army. The report outlines the advantages and risks of using Palantir, specifically its asset readiness suite, about which we also talk more below in this article that you can read, which ultimately led to the rejection of a partnership with the company. The military experts conclude that the data leak from Palantir systems cannot be technically prevented. Let that sink in, flagship tech corporation, in Yuval Harari's infamous terminology, hackable, and this cannot be avoided. This, however, casts doubt on oft-repeated claim by police in Germany that a leak of internal police data is technically impossible. It is likely based on a mere assurance that the U.S. corporation rather than on technical facts. This is because the software is proprietary, making technical insights into an extremely limited, what would be then the police is merely parroting Palantir's talking points about the merits of the product. The four German state police forces and their internal ministries which have entered into contracts with Palantir appear once again ignorant of serious risks associated with cooperating with the company. What well do you think Trump might be doing? Thumbs down for Palantir. The recommendation. The Swiss Army should consider alternatives to Palantir. European companies offer comparable solutions and are more familiar with data protection and security requirements. Examining open source options or developing an integrating in-house data analytics platform could be ways to maintain control over critical systems and reduce dependencies. My Siberian gulag token citizen. The development should not be undertaken in isolation, but rather with partners who appear open, trustworthy, ethical, and sovereign in order to ensure secure, sustainable, and productive collaboration. These are all attributes that Palantir is decidedly not. In this context, the following key questions, among others, need to be addressed. How is the Army's technological independence guaranteed? And how can the protection of sensitive data be assured? Which alternatives to external providers strengthen sovereignty and minimize risks? At the same time, the ethical and legal compatibility of external solutions, as well as their long-term cost-benefit ratio, must be evaluated. And I would say you should take that list of five or six things and apply them to yourself and do your evaluations with whatever that anybody offers you, in particular any government. Did Trump take that list? Finally, he says, geopolitical risk and strategic dependencies and international collaborations must be critically analyzed to develop a sustainable and independent strategy. And I'm not so sure they use sustainable in the way of the global, but doesn't matter. They're asking questions, they sought answers, and they couldn't find them. For reasons stated above, the experts recommend against using solutions from Palantir Technologies Incorporated. The issue of operational readiness will be addressed in 2025 within the framework of the Army's specific AI strategy through Army planning. And there you have it, in writing, straight from the horse's mouth, Palantir Incorporated is the opposite of open, trustworthy, ethical. It was also observed elsewhere that after a risk assessment of the use of Palantir software in Switzerland, the fear is that Palantir is handing over sensitive data to the U.S. and from there to Israel. And as you know, Trump has handed the American keys to this foreign subverter, but this is a much, much longer report, so get the link in the Blogcaster so you can pour through it, read all the graphs, the statements, come right off the websites, show you how and explain how you are talked to by these folks. They put on a good show, but behind the scenes, no different than the Kohler security and encryption, isn't what they're telling you. And yet, again, Trump is giving Palantir carte blanche, they're giving Oracle carte blanche. They're utilizing Pegasus and Predator against us. And who's benefiting? Swiss Army seems to be on to something. Israeli reportedly spying on American troops as U.S. base monitoring Gaza ceasefire. The base's commander apparently had to summon the Israeli counterpart to demand an end to the practice. Israeli authorities are reportedly conducting widespread surveillance and recording in a U.S. base set up in southern Israel in October to monitor the Gaza ceasefire. Guardian reports that the foreign diplomats and other visitors to the base, like humanitarian officials, are sometimes told to avoid sharing sensitive information for fear that it will be exploited by Israel, creating an atmosphere of paranoia among visitors. All right, so that's in practice. The surveillance causes paranoia. Now look at the United States and what Trump's bringing in and what's going on in every aspect of your life. A wide range of information could be under discussion there, as U.S. military officials have previously boasted that the representatives from 50 nations and international groups are operating with the group. The monitoring is so widespread that the commander of the base, Patrick Frank, had to summon his Israeli counterpart to tell him the recording has to stop here, the publication reports. The base is known as the Civil Military Coordination Center, the CMCC, and is located in southern Israel in the building where the disastrous Gaza Humanitarian Foundation once operated. The CMCC's stated purpose is to monitor the ceasefire and aid its implementation, including flow of humanitarian aid. It was also established to implement President Donald Trump's colonialist 20-point plan for the future of Gaza. The base is home to discussions and meetings between foreign military officials, diplomats, and aid workers on subjects like restoring Gaza's hospitals and schools and building out public services like water and sanitation. Palestinians, who are referred to only as Gazans within the U.S. military planning documents, are excluded from the process. Another person who was just excluded was Tony Blair. And I think Peter Thiel, was instrumental in not allowing that happen. And Peter Thiel is the one that investigates or invests in Israel's army and also supports Vance, Vice President Vance, and partly likely how he got there to be vice president. Those seeking to help Palestinians in Gaza under siege, famine, and blockade are stuck in a catch-22 where they feel that they should cooperate with the CMCC but are wary of what to share for fear of the information landing in Israeli hands. Quote, "We are really unsure how much time and energy to invest," one source told The Guardian, "but this is the only chance we have of the Americans listening to us." Israel has denied conducting surveillance at the facility, calling the report absurd, though noted that the information discussed that there is unclassified. The report also found that dozens of U.S. logistics experts left the CMCC after just a few weeks of its establishment because they found that it was not logistics issues, but Israelis' restrictions on humanitarian aid that were preventing getting into entering Gaza. Israel maintains extremely sophisticated in-depth surveillance programs. This includes highly detailed surveillance of Palestinians in the occupied territories, as well as historically a vast amount of spying on American citizens and officials. Brazenly, bizarrely, U.S. officials even seem to welcome Israel's spying. Are we the people listening to this? The government is embracing this. Last month, U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee welcomed infamous Israeli spy Jonathan J. Pollard for a friendly U.S. meeting at the embassy in Jerusalem. Is it bizarrely when you consider these U.S. government officials are Zionist Federation Movement first enemies within the gate? And because of all this wonderful news about Israeli corruption, Israel sharply hikes propaganda budget. West Jerusalem is expected to allocate nearly $729 million, Mike dollars, to public diplomacy efforts in the next fiscal year. Now, perception management is called public diplomacy, just like Zionist diplomacy with Gaza, fraudulent, deceptive, criminal. The move constitutes a significant strategy decision, the top diplomat stated, adding that, quote, "When public opinion shifts toward an anti-Israeli stance in a third country, it can, quote, promptly impact government actions," close quote. The second decision is the approval of the budget of 2.35 billion shekels, of which 1 billion shekels is authorized for the battle for public awareness and promotion of Israel's image worldwide. The concept that the battle for public awareness is part of a national security was fundamental to this decision, he said. You get that, folks? The public awareness is a part of national security. No different than I've been talking to you about the United States military and what it does to you, and with the help of the Modernization Act and Smith-Mundt, which I think Massey was also put a bill in to get repealed. So, national security and public awareness. The impressive little statement right there, if you've appreciated, I guess, I hope, what I've been trying to tell you all these years about those subject matters. Last year, Israel allocated some $150 million for public diplomacy, 20 times more than what has been spent on average over the previous years. So the battle affecting Zionist security is the public becoming aware that illegal belligerent occupying Zionist Federation movement posing as a legitimate government in the Palestinian territory they invaded from Semitic peoples is being found out. And now they expect your heart and soul can be bought for nearly $750 million. Israel's international image has been badly damaged by the conflict in Gaza. Nearly 70,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza during the conflict, according to local health authorities, while nearly 90% of the enclave's population is internally displaced. Israel has faced accusations of genocide from multiple foreign nations and international bodies. But I would have to say Israel hasn't faced a thing, not a thing. And speaking of corruption knowing no bounds, what about the accountability for the chief genocider? I think we've heard about this honor among thieves lately. Satan Yehu asked Israeli President Herzog for pardon amid trial. The Israeli Prime Minister is currently facing charges of three cases of bribery, fraud, and a breach of trust. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has sought a presidential pardon for accusations of receiving expensive gifts or positive coverage in the media from wealthy figures in exchange for political favors. While the investigation started in 2019, Netanyahu's trial started in 2020. He has repeatedly delayed its proceedings. Netanyahu rejects all accusations, calling them a witch hunt. Siamese Trumpensteins. Witch hunting. Sure getting a lot of mileage. And one of the first Epstein associates identified in the recent Epstein emails will suffer some consequence, apparently. Finally get some accountability, maybe. American Economic Association cites Epstein files, condemns his behavior. Remember who Larry Summers is and his integration with the economic system, the financial system. An esteemed economic association has banned former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers for life, citing his ongoing relationship with Jeffrey Epstein even after Epstein's 2008 conviction for soliciting prostitution from a minor. The nonprofit said Tuesday that it had accepted Summers' resignation and permanently revoked his membership. The 71-year-old, who was a regular speaker at top of economic forums, is barred from attending, speaking at, or participating in any economic association-sponsored events. It is also prohibited from serving in any editorial capacity to AEA journals. The AEA's lifetime ban decision follows the release of emails revealing Summers' continued relationship with Epstein, including requests for dating advice and jokes about women's intelligence. He told Epstein that women he was pursuing viewed him as an economic mentor. The emails also revealed that Summers' relationship with Epstein continued through 2019, when Epstein was arrested in July of that year. In a statement, the group condemned Summers' conduct, quote, as fundamentally inconsistent with its standards of professional integrity and with the trust placed in mentors within the economic profession. Summers, a former Harvard president, has also stepped back from his teaching role in the university while it investigates his Epstein ties and resigned from his position at OpenAI. He also lost a consulting gig at hedge fund D.E. Shaw. After the emails were released last month, Summers, who served in Bill Clinton's administration, apologized, saying, I am deeply ashamed of my actions and recognize the pain they have caused. So I was feeling uneasy about this seemingly apparent guilt by association feel to this, as Trump was concerned about, until Summers said, at least reported in the article, quote, I am deeply ashamed of my actions and recognize the pain they have caused. Not sure that there should be any shame for associating with someone without more interaction. But what pain could have possibly been caused by just associating unless those actions weren't the pain caused to those he victimized? So where is the prosecution? Well, maybe it doesn't matter. After prosecution, Ghislaine Maxwell makes a new plea to get out of prison. Convicted Epstein associate to file habeas corpus petition. But 2 months after getting shut down by the Supreme Court, Ghislaine Maxwell is trying again to get out of prison. In a court filing, U.S. District Court Judge Paul Engelmeyer, on Wednesday, Maxwell's lawyer said she intends to file a habeas corpus petition for her release. The filing did not specify legal grounds for her request, but it did make clear that Maxwell plans to represent herself rather than be represented by an attorney. The filing is a response to the Justice Department's request to unseal grand jury transcripts from the case. Maxwell's lawyers argued the transcripts might contain unproven allegations that would create undue prejudice so severe that it would foreclose the possibility of a fair retrial should Maxwell's release petition be granted. The request coincides with the release of new photos and videos by the House Democrats from Jeffrey Epstein's private Caribbean island. Maxwell is also said to be preparing a commutation request for President Trump. And from the let's do everything other than immediately stop the genocide department, Palestinian state only solution, says the Pope. The fallible one, a step up the Vatican's appeal for a two-state push during the Middle East trip. Appealing to who in what lost court case? A two-state solution is the only option that can guarantee justice for Israelis and Palestinians, Pope Leo XIV has said. Pray tell, Mr. Fallible One, what is justice for the illegal belligerent occupiers committing genocide, or killing Christians and destroying holy sites? What guarantee? Why are you making a usurpacious political statement that runs contrary to the Palestinian determination? He made the remarks while flying from Turkey to Lebanon on Sunday for the second leg of his first international trip as pontiff. The Vatican formally recognized Palestinian statehood in 2015, and the Holy See has repeatedly backed a two-state solution. But the Fallible One nor the Vatican have the right to insist on a two-state solution, nor a splitting of the Holy Land, nor in favor of the synagogue of Satan or the Zionist political movement. His comments on the flight, however, marked the strongest call yet for official international recognition amid the war in Gaza. Well, I mean, he's already given it, hasn't he? The Vatican did. It's just they didn't follow through. The Palestinian statehood cannot exist without the entirety of the territory of Palestine pursuant to international law, and no different the principle than Russia entered the Donbass to protect the people there, as I've explained before. Quote, we all know Israel does not accept a solution at the moment, but we see it as the only one, Leo told reporters. No, what they want is a one-state solution and no Palestinians. Nothing like what was supposed to be set up or could be set up. Earlier this month, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that his country's opposition to a Palestinian state was, quote, not changed one bit, close quote, and is not threatened by external or internal pressure. Quote, I do not need affirmations, tweets, or lectures from anyone, he said. But the only solution, no, it isn't. And quit looking with one blind eye. If the people identifying themselves as Israeli cannot peacefully coexist in Palestine as Muslims, Christians, and Jews, so-called, have largely peacefully existed together for centuries, then their only other option is for the warmongering Zionist political movement to settle a small rock outcropping in the South China Sea, leaving the Holy Land undivided, largely historically among the faiths peaceful. Even in Tehran, Iran, it is recently reported the Holy Virgin Mary metro station was officially opened in the presence of priests and representatives of the Christian community in Iran. So why does the Fallible One reiterate dividing the Holy Land because of some blasphemous friendship with the evildoers of the synagogue and the Magog of Satan? Well, we are also friends of Israel, he added, saying that the Vatican could continue to act as a mediating voice to help move forward a solution with justice for all. So he's friends with genocide? Got it. Okay, all right. Now tell me how that fits into all things holy. And how can a Vatican be mediating voice when it sides with and condones evil? The U.S. brokered October 10 truce called for an Israeli pullback and a release of 20 Israeli hostages in exchange for about 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. But Israel's strikes have continued and aid flows lag, leaving conditions dire, U.N. agencies and regional mediators say. Vatican mediator indeed. I see how you is. And this is the Catholicism that almost a fifth of the world agrees with? Yeah, maybe all the ungodliness can join with your satanic ritual sacrifice, murderous friends, and the settling of a small rock outcropping in the South China Sea. Oh, and you can wear your half-man fish god mitre and fit right in with the sea life there. And looking back through this nonsense where we're looking at Palestine, wanted to go back quick and found a post that fact-checked Trump's 8 wars that he's ended. And we hear nothing today that it's ended. President Donald Trump continues to tout ending 8 wars as a key diplomatic achievement, but the reality is a bit different. And I'm bringing this up here. We're supposed to have the 2 most powerful people in the world, one the political, one the religious. And that the war there, the genocide, continues with their oversight, their look. So let's go look. The failures of the fallible one, we can find the failures there. He's not doing a darn thing. Let's go look at the other side. Trump, the Cambodia and Thailand conflict ended with a July ceasefire. Now fighting is resumed with new airstrikes. Well, now it's now off again, on again. Nothing is peaceful there. Nothing is really settled. DRC, Rwanda, peace deal signed at the Trump Institute, leading rebel coalition refused to sign. Recently, a bomb killed 30-plus in Congo. The peacemaker in Ethiopia and Egypt, not a war, but a long-running diplomatic dispute over a dam. He took credit for that as ending a war. Serbia, Kosovo, no war occurring during Trump's term. Israel, Hamas, ceasefire in October, attacks in Gaza have continued since. Well, they don't say who. Israel is attacking. And we heard all the conditions that are going on. We heard the surveillance that's going on. We heard the one-sidedness of the decisions. And nothing is going to twist Satan Yehu's mind. Nothing. Israel-Iran, truly a hot war in June of 12 days of missile strikes. He claimed for that, but that was really a concession. India-Pakistan ceasefire after April terror attack. India denies U.S. negotiated it. Armenia-Azerbaijan, White House declaration to seek peace, final agreement never signed, and then Trump didn't know where those places actually were. And so here we have people in the world that would be able to have the power to do something, doing nothing against literal evil. This has been BTWRLM 658, and I'll be with you next week. Tech Tips, or nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn. Dose by dose, behind the woodshed, no stone unturned.
Next week, heed the call, behind the woodshed standing tall.